Hi, I'm Michael Sunoff, founder and CEO of HardToFindSeminars.com. For the last 5 years, I've interviewed the world's best business and marketing minds. Along the way, I've created a successful publishing business all from home from my two-car garage. When my first child was born, he was very sick, and it was then that I knew I had to have a business that I could operate from home. Now my challenge is to build the world's largest free resource for online downloadable MP3 audio business interviews. I knew I needed a site that contained strategies, solutions, and inside angles to help you live better, to save and make more money, to stay healthier, and to get more out of life. I've learned a lot in the last 5 years, and today I'm going to show you the skills you need to survive.
What percentage increase do you think you could achieve if you could implement that properly and be very, very conservative, put the most conservative figure you can think of? And we start to get a build-up of a picture within the software, and they can begin to see, okay, I know I can do that, and I know that's possible. So now the fear of taking the next step has pretty much gone, because they can see it's all monetized. They can see exactly what they could gain from it if it is properly implemented.
Hi, it's Michael Sunoff with Michael Sunoff's HardToFindSeminars.com. Here's another recording with a gentleman named Robert Clay. He's the founder and CEO of DSP Solutions UK Limited. He's an author, speaker, and designer of world-class, low-risk, high-return marketing strategies. The purpose of this interview is to expose you, the HMA consultants, to other marketing consultants. Consultants who are maybe doing things a little bit different, but some of the same things you're doing in your HMA practice. It's also to broaden your horizon and show you the potential in this business. Wait until you hear the stories, and wait until you hear me uncover Robert's system for generating very high-paying clients. You'll hear how he's using seminars to generate these clients in the most efficient manner. Robert has an amazing history. Let me tell you a little bit about him. At 19, with no capital, in 3 years, he started a business that achieved 40% penetration of initial market potential compared to 17 nationally for all other brands combined. He achieved much press from coverage in the Sunday Times, Sunday Telegraph, Guardian, Observer, and many other regional newspapers and industry publications. Then at 23, he started franchising. He ran successful marketing campaigns, which took his business to number 3 in the UK within 3 years with other franchises worldwide. He invented the glass sunroof as we know it today, creating from scratch a market in the UK for more than 250,000 units a year within 3 years, when it became the third largest sunroof manufacturer in Europe. Eventually, he sold both of these businesses to one of the largest companies in Europe and was instrumental in taking that business to number 1 in its field in the world within only 4 years. He started consulting with other entrepreneurs and business owners, clarifying and demystifying marketing and transforming their thinking and business results. He set up his consulting firm called DSP in the year 2000 as an experiment, and has since helped hundreds of businesses to transform their marketing and business fortunes using low-risk, high-return marketing strategies. Some of his successes include helping a number of business startups to achieve market leadership in their field, or in the UK, or in Europe, or in the world. One was a national Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year Award winner in 2002, who later appeared on the Sunday Times Rich List and sold out in December 2007 for £75 million. Another was the Entrepreneur of the Year runner-up the same year. Another award-winning client went from startup to £100 million revenue in 7 years. Over the last 10 years, DSP has developed a unique and priceless 250,000-page knowledge base detailing best marketing practices worldwide in every conceivable industry. Robert continually writes books and regular columns in magazines and newspapers. He's highly regarded keynote speaker, meeting or exceeding 99.7% of audience expectations. He runs regular workshops and entrepreneurs. His specialty is in designing low-risk, high-return marketing strategies for entrepreneurial businesses. He's a provider of knowledge and facilitation in the area of customer acquisition, better conversion of leads to clients, customer retention, increased transaction value, and increased transaction frequency. He runs regular seminars and workshops. He masterminds, creates, implements, and sustains all marketing activities for a limited number of clients without charging a fee but being paid out of the increased profits. If you're one of my HMA consultants listening to this, I know you're going to benefit immensely. If you're listening to this and you want to become an HMA consultant, the purpose of this interview is to broaden your horizon, show you how other big players are making it in the consulting business. Now let's get going. You know, I've got these HMA consultants that I train on how to become a marketing consultant, myself and a gentleman named Richard Johnson. And I've been doing that since the end of 2004. And I'm always trying to bring them new ways to look at consulting. We have a system that we show them how to use, but no one system is the right system. And if a consultant can learn from someone else who's actually in the field doing high-end, high-level consulting, if you're doing something a little bit different, that's a benefit I've feel for the consultant out there, because there's really no rules as long as it's ethical, and I like to give them a good menu of expertise and experience to learn from.
Yes, that's fine, Michael.
So I'd love to just talk about your experience. Because of the time, I want to get right into the consulting stuff and maybe with some case studies. You've got a fascinating background, and if time permits, we could go into a little bit of that or maybe schedule it another time. Or if we are not able to do that, I can certainly write up. And you've got your summary up on LinkedIn and such.
Yes.
Maybe 2.5 years ago, I'm pretty sure we corresponded a little bit by email. Do you remember that?
We did. Actually, it goes back longer than that, Michael. Goes back to around 2000, I think, when we first had contact. It was just after you were beginning to sell Hard to Find Seminars.
Wow, can you believe
that?
That
was one of your early clients. I think it would have been about this time, 2000, and I bought from you Protégé Mentor Set.
Was it when I had stuff on eBay?
Yes. It was when you were fairly early into that, because when did you first start that?
2000, I would have been fairly early, just getting going. You know, I may have had a one-page site at that time. I was selling stuff on eBay. I was buying and selling the pre-owned Abraham stuff and piecing it up and selling it on eBay. So at that time, were you looking to get into consulting, or were you already full into consulting back in 2000?
I was already in it.
You were?
Yes.
So tell me, what do you currently do? What business is Robert Clay in relationship to the consulting business? Are you selling any kind of opportunities, or are you just doing it on your own? You're a consultant on your own.
No, I have a team of people. There's around 20 of us. Well, it is exactly 20 of us. And it started really as an experiment. And the experiment was around, I'd got to know a lot of top authorities in the world in different topic areas. And in conversation with every one of these people, the same thing came out. And that is, if people seek you out and they pay you good money for your knowledge, your experience, and your skills, there's only a very, very small percentage chance that you would ever recognize that they have applied your knowledge into what they're doing because they implement so badly. And I've since come to the conclusion it's about 3% chance that somebody will actually go away and implement well. And every one of the people I spoke to was frustrated by this. And so I figured, well, there must be, you know, another dimension that's missing beyond imparting information to people in whatever method is used. It could be by seminar, it could be by writing books, it could be any number of different ways. But broadly speaking, you can pretty much guarantee that somebody can pay good money for that information and they'll do nothing with it, or nothing that you would recognize as the originator of that concept. So the experiment was to say, okay, now if we give people the knowledge to do this themselves, and we also facilitate the process, and we employ a facilitator who will hold that person by the hand and take them step by step through the implementation to make sure the implementation is done, what difference would it make? And then we've had clients that have gone from startup to market leadership in a relatively short period of time. We've had clients that have gone from startup to, if I put it in US dollar terms, $200 million a year in sales within 7 years from startup with us working with them in that sort of method. And we've had a lot of successes. And we still do that. We have people that work with us who are acting as facilitators working with clients, where the clients in theory are doing this themselves, and they vary a lot, of course. Some of them do it very well, and some of them are hopeless.
Well, let me ask you this. You say there's 20 of us. Do you have an office where you have 20 people all there, or is it a virtual team, or how does it look?
It's a combination. We had everybody in the office until about 2 years ago, and we started taking on one or two people that were geographically not in close proximity to the office.
Were they employees under your ownership?
They all were until that time.
Okay, so you started out as a team. You were the employer, and you had employees.
Yes. And we still have a group of us who are in the office, employed full-time in different roles. But in addition to that, we started experimenting with outsourcing certain tasks to different people. And we had a lot of success with that, and the model worked very nicely. So we've done more of that. So we have a combination.
But how are you listed, like, in the Yellow Pages? Are you a consulting firm?
I don't think we even have gone into the Yellow Pages.
But what do you categorize your operation as?
We'd come under the marketing heading.
You're under marketing. Marketing services and consulting.
Yes. Because if I was to summarize it in just a few words, I would say to somebody that I would specialize in designing marketing strategies for companies that want to become market leaders. But it goes way beyond that. I mean, that's really only just the start of it.
All right. So you're describing to me, maybe for example, you bought the Protégé training. You bought some information, Jay Abraham's version, on how to go out and be a marketing consultant. And I'm sure you remember going through that, where that's just information that shows you how to do it. And then what you're talking about, your group put together, was the difference between information and execution. And you found that made all the difference.
Well, it made a very big difference. Now, I have to qualify that because it all depends on the client. There are certain types of clients we don't take on because it's nearly impossible to get the level of responsiveness we want. For example, I don't know if the same thing will apply in the US, but I think it would to some degree. Professional partnerships we don't like because you have a lot of people who have to arrive at consensus to do anything, and the result is they get nothing done. So we find them frustrating to deal with, and they would have to give us a very convincing reason why we should work with them, for example. Others, you know, we tend to work with more entrepreneurial people, so I would say we don't like to work with corporates for the same reason. You've got a lot of politics, you've got a lot of different hidden agendas, it complicates the process, it slows it down, and so on, and life's too short. So we tend to work with entrepreneurial people, either business owners or key leaders within entrepreneurial businesses who have to do things in an entrepreneurial way and have to produce results out of thin air.
Can we talk about your current system for generating clients? Are you at the point where all your clients are coming to you based on referrals, or are you still doing any kind of cold prospecting?
We have never done any cold prospecting ever. We haven't yet gone out to find a client.
You have no trouble having clients come to you?
I have clients in a waiting list to get a proposal because it's limited by our capacity to deal with them. Some of them have to wait many months before we can even put together a proposal.
So all these clients are based on referrals and word of mouth?
Referrals and word of mouth and recommendation, yes. And there are other things that will perhaps bring us into somebody's orbit. If they hear me speaking at a seminar or a function, or they read articles that I've written, I write articles for a number of business magazines and so on, then they will generate awareness and they will generate a steady flow of inquiries from people that may not have come across us from referral.
What could you tell my consultants? Many of them don't have much consulting experience. Some have studied Abraham, Chet Holmes, and some of the materials that I've sold on my site. What could you tell my consultants what your consulting operation is like when you don't have to prospect for clients and you have a waiting list? How is the positioning different compared to someone out there cold prospecting, making telemarketing calls and direct mail lead generation? I just want you to paint a picture of how great it is, I guess.
Well, it's very different. The first thing I should say is that we suffer from cobbler's shoe syndrome. Does that mean anything to you?
Yes.
So cobbler shoe syndrome, it's the person who mends the shoes who always has holes in their shoes. It's the financial advisor giving advice to everybody else who never looks after their own finances. In our case, we're helping people with marketing and we never get time to actually do it for ourselves. That's something we want to remedy because we've got fantastic systems for doing that, but we've never got around to it because whenever we think about it, we're always having to deliver something for clients, so it gets put on the back burner. So it's not that we don't want to do it, it is just that we have been too busy delivering to do it. And I would say that the reason this has come about is that we have always delivered a very, very sincere, very genuine, and very high quality service to our clients. That doesn't mean to say that I'm satisfied with it, because I will never be satisfied with it. But I think in comparison with any alternatives I've seen, we're in a different dimension, and maybe some of the documents I sent across to you today will give you some sense of that.
Yes. Can you take me through the process when, let's say, a call comes into your office and it's a prospective client? Take me through that process from the call coming in to, I guess, signing an agreement or a contract to do marketing with them. What happens when a call comes in?
Okay, I'll give you an example that happened yesterday, fresh in my mind, and it's probably quite illustrative. One of my clients was the president of one of the major industry associations in financial services. He is one of the highest earning financial advisors in the UK, one of the top 1% in the world. And he has taken on a number of other things. He runs a coaching program for an organization called Strategic Coach based in Toronto. I don't know if you know them, but they're an outstanding setup. And they have very strict qualifying criteria.
Is that Dan Sullivan, Strategic Coach, and they're in Toronto?
Yes, it's absolutely fantastic. People have to prove an income level before they can even be taken into the program and various things like this, but it's a wonderful program. And so he is a coach in the UK for this. The people who coach for that program are all people who've been through the program themselves. And so at one of the sessions that he was doing there, some very prominent people within the financial services industry were in attendance, and I don't know how the conversation came up, but he recommended us to these people. We had never heard of them, but they're a very well thought of practice in that industry. We received a phone call from them based on that referral. I knew nothing about it until basically they turned up here yesterday at an arranged meeting and was asked to come into the meeting at some point. Any inquiries we get like that would normally just go through our reception and would be channeled to one member of staff who will deal with those inquiries. And that member of staff would have had a conversation with them on the phone and concluded it was worth having a meeting. So we will always do a free consultation.
Was there any qualifying by your staff member before you set the meeting?
Yes.
Okay, so this is really important because I see a lot of consultants really drop the ball and waste time when they fail to qualify even before that first meeting. What are you looking for before you set that meeting?
We're looking for, if you like, an entrepreneurial attitude. We're looking for people who are significant growth. We're looking for people who are prepared to make a commitment, because if we work with them to help them to do it themselves, they're going to have to put a lot of work in. They've got to be willing to learn. They've got to be open to a lot of ideas they may never have considered before. So we're looking for all of those things. We're looking to make sure they actually have enough resource to be able to do something worthwhile, not just in terms of financial resource, but obviously their attitude and so on as well. And we're kind of looking for all of those things. And if we detect that those things are there, we will then suggest, okay, come and meet us. When we do this, and I'm very strict on this point, we get them to come to us. We do not go to them.
Yeah, that's a good position.
And a lot of people make an absolutely classic mistake. They go to the prospective client. Well, you're coming almost begging when you do that. Plus, you cannot control the environment you're in. If they have a crisis going on, if they have all kind of interruptions going on, at the moment, you are not that important to them. They've lived without you up until now. They can make a decision to live without you forever after. So if there are things happening, they're making no commitment to come to you. So we won't speak to anybody until they've made the commitment to come to us.
I think that's great positioning. Sorry for interrupting. That's excellent positioning. You've got an office. Let's say our independent consultants, you know, working out of their home. What would you suggest? Would you suggest that they meet at a place of your choice outside of the home?
Well, you could use a hotel, but again, the prospect has no idea what kind of a setup you are. You can do exactly the same thing in the U.S. as we do here. You probably do it in the U.S. much more than we do here, in fact, because you're ahead of us on most of these things. But you can set up virtual office arrangements with Turkish office companies, where for a very small monthly payment, they will take your calls. You can hire a meeting room whenever you want it. Now, we don't do that, but it's a very easy way of doing it. You can have all the presence in some very prime locations using the virtual office arrangement, and it really costs very little, so you can be operating from home and you can meet people in a nice location.
Great idea. All right, continue.
Now, our location is actually a very good one because we are in beautiful premises which are right in the center of the main business district of the fastest growing town in Europe, which is a new city, very much modeled on American lines. It's got grid roads, which is unique in the UK. There isn't another one. There never will be another one. There isn't space to do another one. So we are right in the center of that, in the main business center. It's a city called Milton Keynes, which is about 1 hour north of London if you drive, about 35 minutes north of central London if you go by high-speed train. It's a very nice sort of location, so people come and the whole setup will impress them. We also believe that our attitude is also very important because we believe in being very sincere, very genuine. We're not there to try to take the money off them. We're there to help them to achieve something that they couldn't achieve without us. We believe we're there to provide good hospitality while they're here. Quite often if they will come, you know, we have 61 different drinks that we can offer them, so they can have coffee and tea in different ways. They can have different types of tea. They can have herbal teas. They can have cold drinks, they can have soft drinks. So we have a whole lot of ways of looking after them. We will normally send someone to greet them. They'll be announced when they arrive in reception. Someone will go to greet them. We'll make sure that they have nice refreshments. They're taken through to our meeting room. The whole building is very nicely furnished. And without being excessive, but it's very nicely furnished. The building's now 8 years old, but we came in here when it was first built. Looks attractive from the outside, looks nice on the inside. And so we place a great deal of store on the, if you like, the hospitality side of it. We're very friendly. That is one of our values. We never speak in jargon to people. One of our rules is whether we are working with somebody in their marketing or whether we're working with prospects of our own, we should speak in terms that a nine-year-old would understand if you really want to communicate with people. So never any jargon. We never try to bamboozle people. Very straightforward, sincere, warm, friendly. When we do a consultation, we then basically would spend 2 to 3 hours. We don't charge for that. And in those 2 to 3 hours, the majority of the time is not spent talking about us. It's talking only about them.
Are you in on all these consultations?
No, not a hope with my sort of workload. I very rarely do them these days.
Okay, so you have trained staff to do this?
Well, yes, I have one member of staff who does that, maybe two at a pinch, but I only have one really who does that. And it's not an ideal person either, but it's good enough. And the basic thing is we will spend, I would think, the best part of 2 hours, maybe 2.5 hours, really understanding that business. And I have a formula for doing this. And essentially, the acronym to remember is WHATS. So it's, what do you do? The W in WHATS, W-H-A-T-S. What is it you do? What else do you do? And we really sort of get an understanding of what they do. I might say, okay, what's the background? What did you do originally? How did you get to this? And we'll be making notes. We will have laptops in there, and we will make notes as we're going through the conversation. We say, do you mind if we just make notes? And we make notes in a fairly structured way. So we get a real understanding of what it is. We're not afraid of asking a lot of questions to get absolute clarity on exactly what it is. And obviously, if you are dealing with a lot of different companies, a lot of different industries, you get a map in your mind, you can kind of see a lot of connections between different things, so you can start to ask sensible questions. So we want to find out what they do, we want to find out how they get their business, because we're helping them with marketing, so how do they get the business, and what things that they do are the most effective, and what things that they tried and not worked, and what things are particularly effective. So that's the how. The A is, you know, we want to know, okay, geographically, where do you operate? Do you operate just locally? Do you operate nationally? Do you operate internationally? What is the range of your operations geographically? The T is, who is your target client, your ideal target client? What sort of people would you be wanting a lot more business from? And all of these things are then giving us a picture. Then the S is, what is special about your business? Why should I buy from you? Why would I come to you instead of somebody else? You know, give me all the things that are special. And we push them and we push them and we get a lot of information out of them on that. We then will start to talk about what really matters to them as people to get an understanding of where they're coming from, where they're going to, etc. We will try to then look at what are the barriers to achieving what they want. And that's, if you like, the mental structure we're going through when we're asking them questions and getting a feel for them. And again, as you become skilled at this, you can pick up on lots of little things they say, not at ease all the time. If they come at a time, maybe it's over lunchtime, we will ask one of our teams to go and get some sandwiches or some other food. Sometimes we might just retire to a restaurant in the right circumstances, not always, but we'll normally just bring it in.
Let me just interject. So what I'm hearing you saying is, an unskilled consultant, maybe who's been trained in a system, may look at this first meeting and have an agenda to try and sell consulting, you know, shove consulting down their throat. But it sounds like this meeting isn't about you, it's about them. It's about finding their needs, their desires, and you don't have any agenda to sell them consulting services during this meeting.
No. We're entirely focusing on them and understanding them and getting to know them. No, we're focusing on them. And then from that understanding that we're getting, and you know, a lot of questions will then arise out of this, we'll get under the skin of that company, we can then determine whether and maybe to what extent our skills and expertise and knowledge can actually help them. And if we don't believe they're a good prospect, if we don't believe there's any mileage in it, we won't hesitate to tell them that, because I promise you, you don't just go after any business for the sake of it. There's nothing worse than getting business that isn't the right business, because life's too short. You give yourself hassle you do not need somewhere down the track if you cannot deliver, or if there's unreasonable expectations, or they have the wrong values, or whatever it might be. So we're looking for a values match. We're looking for people that have some of the qualities I mentioned a bit earlier. We're looking for people that we can get passionate about what they do, as much as they are, perhaps even more than they are in some cases. And if we have those basic things in place, we then will say to them, well, fine, now that I've got a basic understanding of what you're about, you know, I can definitely see there are ways we can help you to do this, this, and this, but we will not sell them what we can do for them at that stage.
You're listening to an exclusive interview found on Michael Sinoff's hardtofindseminars.com. Okay, so that meeting, the person who meets with your prospective client, after they go through the questioning, the what's stage, let's say they decide it's not for them, will they let them know during that meeting? And then if it does look like a good fit, will you get back with them, or will you let them know that it could be a good fit during that same meeting?
There are several alternatives. The first thing is, if we really don't think it's going to help them, or we think maybe they just do not have the resource to do it or whatever else, we'll say, look, love what you're doing, if we do, and if we don't, we wouldn't say that, but, you know, you're not ready for us yet. You need to do X, Y, and Z. And if you do X, Y, and Z, and you still want to talk to us at that stage, then come back and see us again, and we'll be delighted to see you and talk about it. And we have left people on that note on a very friendly basis, and we said, okay, this is the reason why I think it's beyond you at this stage. And they have come back to us months or sometimes years later. They've done some of those things, they've moved on, and they are ready to make the next leap. And it's the right fit, and they really appreciate the fact that we said to them, you know, this is not right at the present time. Now, majority of times it doesn't happen because we've qualified people before they've even come to that meeting. But sometimes that happens. Let's say then that we believe we could really help them. Now, this just purely depends on the scale of the potential client. If it is a small business, a startup business, just a few people in the business, a business that's struggling to stay afloat, I probably wouldn't get involved in this. And my colleague would normally say to them, well, the first thing to do is really, we believe we can help you, but rather than start setting out what we can do and so on, we can just do it in the broadest terms, we can help you to do this, this, and this, and this. But rather than do that, we would like you to put us to the test before you decide to do business with us.
Okay, what does that mean?
We will invite them to come to a 3-day workshop, which I run regularly. I was doing 2 of these a month. I'm not doing them with that frequency anymore. And this is a very intensive 3-day workshop. And it starts at 8 a.m., finishes about 7 p.m. for 3 consecutive days. And in that workshop, we will go through 53 different things they can do to grow their business. And these are the things that we found generically apply to almost every business. Some things are more applicable to some businesses than others, but we go through this. They each have a computer in front of them. They have special software on that computer. I think I sent you a couple of screen grabs. As we go through each of the different strategies they can use to grow their business, they are doing an assessment of the relevance to their business, and we look at the implications of it in their business for every individual strategy. And that ends up giving a score. You know, all the strategies get some kind of a score. Anything that will be very easy for them to do that they'll be very comfortable doing, they will produce a high result, gets a high score. If it's something that they would not be comfortable with, or it would be difficult, or there's a lot of cost implications or time implications associated with it, it'll get a lower score. And so it ends up over the 3 days that they will actually see in front of them in the software the kind of result that can be achieved if they just do, if you like, the 4 top scoring strategies or the 8 top scoring strategies or whatever the case may be. They can actually see what they can get out of it, where they themselves have been estimating the kind of impact each of these things that we talk about will have on their business.
Is this a free seminar?
No, it's not free. They will pay for that. So that starts at £1,800. It's roughly $2 per pound currently, so call it $3,600 for that. But we say, okay, do this, and we will give a guarantee that if you do not believe by halfway through that the things you've learned are going to transform your business, then just tell us there and then, we'll refund you the money and there's no further commitment. We have never had anybody want that. It hasn't happened once. But a lot of people wouldn't have come had we not offered that. And we say, this will give you a chance to understand where we're coming from. It'll understand what we're all about. It'll understand what we can do for you. It'll understand where you can go with this. And it means afterwards, we can talk about exactly how we can help you. But you will then actually understand where we're coming from. That's what we will do.
Let me ask you this. Before they agree to that seminar, do they have any idea of the type of investment it would cost for your individual consulting?
Mostly not, and you can't actually put a figure on that because that can be different from one situation to another.
Right. What if they ask? Do you have clients who ask, well, you know, what do you guys charge for consulting?
They will often ask during that consultation.
What do you say?
There's different ways that we can do that. Let's say if it was me speaking to the prospects, I'd say, okay, let's look at the different ways you can do it. Number one, you could do it yourself with us guiding you. And if we did it that way, where we have a facilitator working with you, we will agree how many hours a month we are putting into that. We will agree how frequently we meet face-to-face to move things forward. And we also have a way of working with people online. And we can give them a range of costs depending on the amount of input that we're going to give. So we can give them an indication at that stage. If we are going to do it for them, we're getting into entirely different territory. And we never did it for people to begin with. I can explain to you how that came about. But probably 80% of the clients we take on now, we do it for them. And we can give them 2 choices. We can charge them the normal commercial rate for the time and effort we're putting in. And for most of the things that we do, we've created procedures. We know exactly how much time and effort needs to go into producing a particular...
Are you charging per hour?
It's based on an hourly rate, but we'll package it up for a particular type of thing that, you know, it'll be this amount because we know exactly what amount of work is involved.
When you say normal commercial rate, what is normal, really? How do you come about your hourly rate?
For us, normal, for ad hoc consulting, we don't charge less than £150 an hour, which you could say is $300 an hour. So it would be in the £150 to £200 an hour range, so that's to $400 an hour range for, if you like, the basic staff members, if it's me, it's £650 an hour, so call that $1,300 an hour.
All right, so that per hour model, that seems like a lot of the big consulting agencies, you know, like Arthur Anderson and those guys. Isn't that their model, the hourly rate, billable hours?
It might be. I've never looked at how they do it.
Okay.
I don't know. But again, it's not an open-ended thing, because what we will do in that case is we can say, okay, if we're going to do this, it is going to take this number of hours, and then normally we will do certain packages. So if we're building all the marketing foundations for a company, which we put 760 hours into doing that, when we do that, they're not paying a rate that is anything close to those rates. It's a package price. Now, the one alternative is they can just pay the commercial rate, and we have clients that do that, and there's no further commitment there. Or we will do that at a reduced rate, at a substantial reduction. So all we're looking to cover is the cost of our out-of-pocket expenses, and then we will take our income out of a percentage of the actual result achieved.
Oh, I see. So that's if it's a good client and it seems like it's a fit, you'll take a percentage on the growth.
We'll offer most of our clients both alternatives, and they can choose which one they're most comfortable with.
Before we get too far off the subject, I want to get back to that on how you're charging, but let's get back to the seminar. So you put them through the three-day seminar, and what do you see usually happens? Out of those people who come through your seminar, how many people say, hey, I can do this on my own, and they go on their merry way, compared to how many people come to you and say, you know, this is something I'd like you to implement all these steps for us and do the execution?
They fall into three groups. One group, which is a very small percentage, and you're talking about 3%, they have the business acumen, the skills, the intelligence, all these other things, the drive, the passion, to actually go out there. This has been all they've needed. They can just go out there and they can turn in world-class results without any further help. But it's a very small percentage, and they are very far and few between, but I've had the privilege of knowing a few, and I've seen some of them enter the world stage in terms of some of the successes they've had, where that has been the catalyst. So I'd maybe put that at 3%. We have these figures going back over years now. 80% engage us.
When do they engage you? Right after the seminar?
Sometimes even before the seminar is finished.
So they're being sold on the growth of their business by looking at all the different methods, and they say, this looks great, I know it's doable, can you do this for us?
And they are making judgments all the way through, because after each topic, I would get them to score it. So amongst other things, I'm asking them, okay, now, based upon what you now know about what we've just talked about, what percentage increase do you think you could achieve if you could implement that properly and be very, very conservative, put the most conservative figure you can think of? And we start to get a build-up of a picture within the software, and they can begin to see, okay, I know I can do that, and I know that's possible. So now the fear of taking the next step has pretty much gone, because they can see it's all monetized. They can see exactly what they could gain from it if it is properly implemented.
How many people are usually in your seminars?
They vary. They're not big.
6, 8, 10 people?
No. I wouldn't do them as small as that. I don't like to do it with less than 10 or 12. And the bigger ones, and it's only because I'm limited in the space I can put the people within my office, the bigger ones would maybe have 25, 26. But that's as much as we can physically accommodate in a room, because they each have a desk in front of them with a computer and sort of horseshoe shape. We physically don't have a bigger space than that.
Okay, so they come to you and they engage you. Then take me through the process from the time they engage you to, I guess, let's say, how you get the money. How you package out your stuff, how you charge, and how you get the money and the commitment.
If we are doing a facilitation program, which is now the minority, but is where we started, then we will agree just a fixed monthly amount. It's just a fixed fee. It's a fixed fee, and we are delivering a set number of hours over the 12-month period.
Give me an example of a client, what they're paying, and how many hours they're getting for that.
I'll just refer to a proposal I've done for a prospective client today, which is just a small business. And if we are talking about a facilitation program here, we're saying that we're going to give you 120 hours of support over 12 months. That support is going to be provided by phone, by email, by our special online project management software, and by monthly two-hour meetings. And we're saying to them that they're going to have to put in 300 to 500 hours over the year in addition to that. But if they want to achieve significant growth, they're going to have to put a lot more time in than that. I'll read you the words. This is just one of the options we've given. It says, instead of DSP, which is my company, doing your marketing for you, you can do your own marketing support, even guided by a DSP facilitator who will act as your coach, guide, mentor, and sounding board, and will be your source of in-depth knowledge and expertise. You'll receive ongoing one-to-one support and continuing education in the skills you need. 120 hours of support will be provided over 12 months via phone, email, online project management software, and monthly two-hour meetings. While this option appears to offer the lowest financial commitment, it will also require you to invest at least 6 to 10 hours of your own time each week. In other words, some 300 to 500 hours over the year that you won't be able to devote to other things. If you want to achieve significant growth or create as detailed and comprehensive a set of foundation documents as the ones that we would create if we were doing the job for you, your time investment will be a lot greater than indicated here. The cost and availability of your time and your inclination to do the work yourself should therefore be considered carefully when evaluating this option. You will also need to be very disciplined in your approach, since, just as you couldn't expect a tennis player to reach Wimbledon standard the first time they try to play, there will inevitably be a steep learning curve before you become proficient in your new skills. The fee for this option is £1,850 plus sales tax per month, so call that $3,700 a month.
For how long?
Months.
For 12 months?
Yeah. If you pay the entire amount over 4 consecutive months, you'll receive a 10% reduction in the total fee. In other words, 4 equal consecutive monthly payments, each of £5,006.25 plus VAT, call that $10,000. If you're able to pay the entire amount in advance, you'll receive a 20% reduction in the total fee, i.e. £17,760, call that $35,000. So that's how I would put it to them in the proposal, just setting that out.
Do you have any kind of guarantee or anything like that, any risk-free offer?
No, it's not if they go for the facilitation program, and the reason is very simple. We also put as part of our contract, it states there, and we clearly get an understanding of their expectation, and we also set out our expectation, and they are buying into the fact that 90% of the work is going to be done by them. And since 90% of the work is being done by them, we don't have enough control over that, so it's very difficult to guarantee what they may or may not do.
Okay, so a very small percentage go for that after your seminar, is that correct?
Well, it used to be 100%, but we didn't have any other option. Now, 16% will go for that option.
So this used to be the only thing you offered, right?
It used to be the only thing we offered. The guarantee is really when they come to the seminar. It isn't relevant if they don't believe they're going to make a substantial difference. Then the guarantee applies to that, but it doesn't apply to this next stage.
All right, so your previous model was interview, get them to the seminar, and then offer coaching. And then you're going to tell me the story of how you got to the execution part rather than just the coaching. How did that occur?
Very simple. We had a client that did very well, if you like, under the sort of facilitation program, but they realized that they had reached their limits in terms of what they could actually do, and they now really wanted someone to do it for them as opposed to them doing it under our guidance. Because most people have limitations which are much lower than they themselves believe at the time. And most clients, you know, they think, yes, we can do this, we can see it, it's all logical, it makes sense, it's obvious in hindsight. But when it actually comes to it, there are so many day-to-day distractions that prevent them from getting it done that they don't get as much done as they set out to do or that we would like them to do in many instances. So people at some point are going to run into their own limitations. And we started getting clients that had had a lot of success with what we'd done for them, but realized that they needed someone to do it for them. And they tried the alternatives. They tried employing people. They couldn't get people the right caliber. They tried bringing in agencies, and they got ripped off. And they did not get the same sort of caliber of information. And one particular client kept pushing me on this. And he kept saying, you know, the biggest success we had was when we were working with you. We've used various agencies since. They charge us an absolute fortune, and we get nothing for it. I'll just cite you a particular example. This is a retail furniture business who has beautiful furniture showrooms. If you went in there, you'd want to live in it. Absolutely gorgeous. Very upmarket, very, very nice. And they had progressed beyond working with us, and they realized they needed a direct response agency. So they went out there, they found a direct response agency, and it all looked good and sounded good, and this agency worked for them for about a year. They were opening up a new branch, this was in Scotland, a new branch in a very prime area, and the agency had come up with all the advertising for this. And the owner was sort of going through a mental checklist of all the things we taught him, and I thought, hang on one second, nowhere in any of this launch advertising does it even mention anything to do with furniture, and this is a furniture business. This is not going to work. So he called us up and said, look, Connie, please do it, because, I mean, this is absolutely crazy. We're getting these people, they charge us £250,000, you know, $500,000 to do this, and this is what they've come up with, and it will not work at all. It cannot work. So I had meetings with him and basically said to him, look, we can't do that because we do not have robust procedures for doing it for you. And he kept it honest me over a period of about 5 years. And eventually I said to him, okay, if you're prepared to be the guinea pig, then we will develop some robust procedures around what you need. Would that be of interest to you? And because we don't have those robust procedures in place, we don't want to charge you for our time for doing this. We'll just charge you the out-of-pocket expenses, and we will take a percentage of the results actually achieved. Is that a reasonable proposition for moving ahead? And I thought that was a very reasonable proposition for moving ahead. And so we dipped our toes in the water.
And what did you ask for?
The deal is individual to every situation, because what needs to be measured is different. For example, we work for the charity that's working with very large sums of money, and they pay all their overheads and their staff out of a 1% management fee on large sums of money invested. So we would be taking 20% of the increased 1%. In another instance, we're working with a firm firm of financial advisors where you could face 100% gross margin on what they do. So we're working on 20% of any gain above a particular threshold in terms of gross revenues. So it will vary depending on what is appropriate in that situation. But we normally work on either 20 or 25% of certain gains once we have set a benchmark, and we will try to make that very easy to measure. And so that's how we got started with it. And the first project we did, we got 6 times the yield that they had achieved themselves. So, of course, it was considered very successful, and we were asked to do it again, and it moved on. And so we just took on 1 or 2 clients to begin with, just to start to get our procedures right. And me and my PA, really between us, just started pulling all the procedures together and started going step by step through them, refining them as we were doing it, until we felt, okay, we now have a robust procedure, we could go out and do this for somebody else, to the point where, to this day, we've never told anybody publicly we do this, but we have mentioned it to clients in one-to-one situations, and 80% of them have gone for this option.
So what do you like better, the old model where it was more of the coaching, a lot less hands-on, which was probably a better way to leverage your time? Now you're pretty booked and integrated in the actual consulting.
I am, but there's a method to my madness, because it's a matter of having to lead from the front. I've got to develop the procedures and so on, so which we'll develop into robust procedures. Well, the only reason we want to develop robust procedures is to be able to hand over to other people so that they can just follow all the steps that we have now proven. So I am handing over parts of that the whole time to other people within the team, and then as their proficiency is increasing, as I need to oversee what they do less and less because I know that they've got it, it becomes, if you like, a whole way of operating where we can then just bring people in and say, okay, these are the steps you have to follow. That's what we are able to do increasingly. It's just getting to that point.
Let's do a couple case studies. I know time is short. Was that one of your clients, a real estate agent or a broker?
It is. That one, I can't give you results yet because that is still under construction. That is a part completed.
All right, let me ask you this. Was it someone who contacted you in the method that we described, contacted you, came in for an appointment, and then you put them through the seminar?
This was where I had been invited to speak to, it was like a technology exhibition specifically in the real estate agents arena. So it's a national thing that occurs every year, and I was invited to speak, did a half an hour talk on marketing, and particularly for real estate agents, and there was a panel discussion with some well-known TV personalities sort of sharing it and so on as well, which I took part in, and we had quite a busy auditorium, a lot of people there, and I spoke about advertising within the real estate world. I had 45 minutes to do it, did a talk where we've had some big successes in that field. I mean, one agent, we had a 1,700% increase within 12 months. And so we've had some big successes. So I was able to just talk through some of the things that are completely unknown to most real estate agents. And it just opened people's eyes. And I got mobbed at the end of it by people who were sort of thrusting their business cards at me and so on. And we got a lot of leads from that. And this guy was one of those leads from that. In fact, he phoned me 2 or 3 days afterwards. He said, I didn't join the mob at the end of your talk. I thought I'd give you a couple of days to come back to earth and I'd give you a phone call. So he phoned me. We spoke on the phone. I arranged to meet him. He came in for a consultation, as I've described. I was impressed with the guy, I was impressed with what he wanted to do, and thought we could work comfortably with him and put a proposal to him. And in this case, this is the other way we might work after a consultation. I gave him a proposal that, look, we can do it for you, charging, if you like, the normal commercial rate. We can do it for you at a reduced rate, take a percentage of the actual proceeds, or you could do it yourself with us guiding you. And he went for the middle option, do it for him at the reduced rate and take a percentage of the proceeds. We then said to him, we'll come on the workshop anyway, we'll include that as part of the deal. So he came on the workshop anyway, and that was his out. So if this doesn't add up, if you're not comfortable with it, we don't go any further. You know, there's no further arrangement. So he came with several of his team, and the rest is history. We're just putting that together.
Good story. Is there an advantage, in your opinion, by doing consulting work where you're paid on your industry hourly rate compared to the contingency deals where they're not paying as much down and it's on a percentage of the growth of the business? I mean, have you ever had problems where your clients didn't want to pay you or because they were less committed and they're paying you based on results and there were some problems or issues down the road on those measurements?
The only problems we've had is when we've allowed a client to cut corners. I will get asked sometimes by members of my team, can we do such and such, maybe compromise on this? And I won't do it anymore. I've done it a few times, and I've regretted it every time I've done it. Because if you say to a client, okay, this is what you need to do, and they're saying, okay, that is beyond me, I can't reach to that, and you then agree to do some lesser version of it that is not going to work or doesn't have all of the processes in place to make sure that it works, you're hoping it's going to work, and that's not good enough. it's very, very risky because it invariably will not work. And everybody ends up disappointed, and you put a lot of work in and you don't get much for it. The client feels they've paid quite a lot of money and haven't seen anything for that. It just doesn't work. So we only do it one way, and that's properly. And I won't even contemplate cutting corners on something these days. And, you know, I won't contemplate someone rushing me into something. I had a case recently where a very good client wanted a direct mail campaign to be out in the market next month. Well, there's a lot of planning required to get all this right. So he just wanted leads coming in, any leads, at any price almost. And it was severely compromised because it was rushed into existence and it just did not produce the kind of results. So they ended up disappointed. Fortunately, we had an absolutely stunning result out of something else we were doing that had been properly planned and thought through, which compensated for that. But if we'd only been doing that, they could have made a judgment. This is not worth pursuing any further.
For more exclusive interviews on business, marketing, advertising, and copywriting, go to Michael Senoff's hardtofindseminars.com. Let's talk about the vehicle leasing case study, and I'm sure we can get into your intense evaluation on developing a USP. So tell me how the vehicle leasing client came to be, the process that he went through before he became a paying client, and then let's talk about what you did for him and get into some details of your USP development.
Again, he turned up at a seminar, which I delivered on one occasion. Just someone in the audience. I had no interaction with him at the time of the seminar. He was just one of many people there. He was very skeptical. This is a very interesting company. The guy who came to see me eventually, his grandfather was the guy who invented vehicle leasing. It's exactly 100 years ago this year, 1908. I didn't know any of this at the time. But some weeks later, we had a phone call from him, and he'd been thinking over what I'd been talking about at the seminar, and it made a big impression on him. In the entire history of this company, they had never really done any marketing.
Let me ask this seminar, was this a short version seminar or your 3-day?
No, this is a 2-hour seminar.
Okay, 2 hours. Where was it?
It was in the city of Oxford, which I think probably a lot of people would know, one of the famous university cities in the UK, not very far away from where I'm based.
Were you doing it in conjunction with someone?
We were doing this in conjunction with a government agency whose task is to try to help businesses.
Okay, business development through the government.
You could say in broad terms, it's called Business Link. What it's required to do changes frequently as government policy changes frequently, but they are required to touch X number of businesses every year and to bring, if you like, skills and advice and so on to businesses that need it, particularly smaller businesses.
Was it a free seminar for him?
No, everybody had to pay for that.
But it wasn't much because it was a government
program?
Well,
effectively, it was like an official body that was promoting it, and I think we paid the cost of the actual meeting room and so on, so we just tried to recover the cost of, you know, our outgoings in doing something like that.
So this was a deliberate seminar on your part to potentially generate a client, which it did.
Yes. We generated several clients from that one seminar, and we normally would in any situation like that. So he emerged out of the woodwork a few days or a few weeks afterwards. We got a call to say he'd been thinking a lot about this. He had taken everything on board that I was saying, wanted to come and see me, specifically because I had a lot of expertise within the automotive sector. And it was the first time he had ever heard anybody speak about marketing that managed to overcome his skepticism. So he believed we could do something. He wanted to bring a few of his colleagues along to meet me, and he wanted them to hear what I had told them in the seminar. And he turned up in a brand new Ferrari he was on his way to deliver to a client, which was very spectacular. And we all turned out to look at it. We had the meeting. And nothing happened for about 2 years. There was some talk about they wanted us to do something, but they had never engaged in marketing before, and he was nervous about taking that step. But some of his colleagues, who were very keen that they should actually do this, and they put pressure on him over about 2 years. I wasn't even in the picture. And basically came back to me a couple of years later and says, you know we really want to do this. Can we now talk? We persuaded him we should do it. He doesn't like spending money. And so we put together the proposals at that stage. They liked the proposals. They told me, just put together, there's something very brief. He won't live a long proposal. I think we put together 37 pages. It was not a brief one. And he read every word of it, and he came back and said, yes, we want to do it. And we negotiated how we were going to do it, and we got started. And the arrangement in that case was that we would build all of the foundational messages that are going to be needed for their future marketing. And this is what we would do with every company we start to work with. We've put a lot of hours in, a lot of days in, a lot of months in to building all the foundational messages. But we also looked at the very limited marketing they were already doing. It wasn't much. Said, okay, we will revamp all of that once we've got this basic message foundations in place.
Now, are we talking message foundation USP?
Yes.
Okay. What's your definition of a USP? How would you describe that to someone who doesn't know what it is?
I would describe it as essentially, in the simplest form, it is a response to the question, why should I do business with you? And it is a compelling answer to that question that will make somebody want to know a whole lot more. Now, what comes out of that is most people's definition of a USP, and that is just a single sentence or a paragraph, and we would call that a positioning statement, and that is the very last element of the USP that we would create, and the very least element as well. But it can only be done as the last element. We actually would extend this quite considerably to include the entire story that can be told about that business. And every business has a story to tell. I've never met somebody I've been able to sit down with and not find a whole lot of things that they do not tell the world about, because most people in business are too close to their own business to even see things. And let's say you have a business that's very, very good at what they do. They're very good at it all day, every day, to the point where being very good is just what they do on a day-to-day basis. They don't even have to think about it, and they certainly don't think of it as being anything special, because it's just routine to them. But because of this, they never tell people about the things they do that are exceptional.
Have you studied Chet Holmes, you know, his core story?
Well, actually, it's very similar to Chet Holmes' core story. I mean, we did this long before I'd ever heard of Chet or been through that, but it's extremely similar concepts. But I would suggest that perhaps we may go into more detail. I mean, I haven't sat and looked at one he has produced side by side with one we've produced. The same principle.
But it's the story and the reason why. And I was looking in your literature, that could take upwards of 700 hours to develop with a client?
It does take at least that. Now, this may sound like an incredible amount of time to put into this, because most people's idea of a USP is that you'll put something together. And I've seen people do this on stage. I'm sure you can think of the same person I'm thinking of who's come up with the most incredible positioning statement spontaneously in about 2 seconds flat. And I'm sure you know who I'm talking about.
Yes.
It's just a joy to watch. And that's great, but this is actually going to much more than that, because we need to actually understand what are all the reasons why somebody would not do this. Now, if we're talking about vehicle leasing, what is the case against vehicle leasing? What are the frustrations? What are the concerns? What are the issues people have? In what way do they have any distrust of leasing companies? In what ways do they let them down? And what are all the horror stories? Because these are the things that will go around that will deter somebody from doing business with somebody that they've never heard of in that field. So we need to know all those things. We need to know what are all of the reasons why they should do business with this company in particular. And we have to actually build a picture which contrasts all of these things. So a story we will create will normally deal with all of those concerns and issues. So how do we find out what they are? Well, the first thing we do is we will get all of the key people within the company to answer a very detailed questionnaire. They'll have to spend at least 2 days on it each. And we warn them they're going to do this. And they will spend 2 days each on this questionnaire. We might get 10, 15 people within that company doing that. It's normally the key management within that company. And we'll pull all of that information together. And sometimes we'll get tens of thousands of words out of this exercise. But they've all had to answer the same questions. And there's people who've written shorter books, and sometimes the responses we get to that. And this gives us in-depth information. But what's interesting is you may have somebody who founded that business, who knows more about that business than anybody else on the planet, and yet who's absolutely astounded with some of the things that we find out, because there's other people in that business who have different perspectives. And there's probably never, ever been a situation where all of those perspectives have come together in one place. So we will then take all the information we glean from that. We will dissect it. I mean, we will literally take it apart. We'll put it under many different headings. We will dissect it almost to the molecular level. And we will then start to construct, if you like, a framework for what needs to be in this story that has to be told, that's going to be very compelling, that's going to accelerate people's buying decisions and make people buy into this company very, very rapidly.
Let's use the vehicle leasing story. What was surprising about, as you were dissecting and doing your research, to you and coming up with the USP?
Vehicle leasing is a very commoditized business. Almost everybody in that field, I'm not sure it's exactly the same in the US, people buy on price, you know. A Chevrolet is a Chevrolet, and you'd expect the same standard to come out of one dealer as compared to another dealer, one leasing company as to another leasing company. A Toyota is a Toyota. You'd expect the same standard. So people say, okay, how can I get that commodity for the best possible price? So people are basically fighting each other purely on price within that field. Highly competitive, very commoditized, very skinny margins. And that is a very unhealthy way to grow a business. So we were looking for, how can we actually get people to buy into this, to believe in this company? And fortunately, when we started asking those questions, what came out again and again in all the responses was really that this company had an incredible set of values. This is the kind of company you would want to deal with, because they really do care. They do not treat their customers like a number. A lot of people would complain about leasing companies that they need to contact them about something. Their account manager, they can never get hold of them. If they have to phone up 9 times to get something sorted out, they'll speak to a different person every time. There's no relationship there. There's internal politics within these organizations. There's people more interested in ascending the corporate ladder and making sure that the quarter's numbers are a hit than in looking after their customers. That's really exactly the same in the US, I guess, isn't it?
Yes.
That is a normal type of situation, and it's a very commoditized business, but you don't get the level of service that you should in most cases. So we found out that these people actually give incredible service, really personal service that people really like, and they are very genuine. They're not just treating it as a commodity. They are doing their absolute best to make sure that people get something that is far superior to everybody else. This all came out in these sort of questionnaires. But interestingly enough, we also did some other research alongside this, and it was we who discovered that the grandfather of the guy that runs his company invented vehicle leasing. The first ever leasing contract in the world was written by this guy in 1908, and it was for bicycles for the sales reps of Shell Oil Company. There weren't many cars in 1908. The second contract that was ever written was for horses to pull the fuel wagons for BP. And part of the contract on those leasing deals was that those horses had to go to a particular place once a year for several weeks for rest and recuperation.
Where did this information come from?
Well, we just asked questions, and we dug it all out.
Okay.
And we then put together a whole timeline, and you'll see a lot of that in the information I sent you, which actually was a compelling history. This then grew over time into the largest vehicle sales distributorship in Europe, and eventually it was broken up and it was sold to a conglomerate and doesn't exist anymore in that form. But it ended up being a major bit of automotive history, where very early in history there was a brand of vehicles sold in the UK. I don't know if they ever made it to the US. They were terrible, so they shouldn't have made it anywhere, really. There was a brand of vehicles called Morris, and they were one of the traditional brands in the UK. You could say that like Oldsmobile would have been in the US. It's now dead. And for a lot of years they had a big market share here and so on. And this guy, the grandfather of our client, actually bought the entire year's production one year from the manufacturer. We're going back to the 1920s in doing that. So there was this incredible history. Now, the interesting thing is that we were able to build this and many, many other things into this story. And if you said to anybody, would you be interested in reading the history of a vehicle leasing company? Nobody's interested in reading that. Nobody could care less what price and, you know, what's the deal. That's the only thing they're really interested in. But when we tested this on the marketplace, and before we tested it on the marketplace, we tested it on the staff. There wasn't a single member of staff who even knew anything about that history. And immediately, they had a sense of belonging to something with a real heritage. And then when we tested this in the marketplace, we got client after client after client coming back and saying, this is absolutely riveting, it's compelling, I feel really comfortable with this company, they've been here 100 years, I know that they're not going to rip me off today and disappear out of business tomorrow. Or the chances of that happening are extremely remote, and it happens to be the most profitable vehicle leasing company in the UK. It is extremely profitable, and they give a fantastic service, and all of this then came out into this story. Well, this was based upon the information we got from their key team members, and we got lots of perspectives from this, which we're able to incorporate into this whole story. Before we write that story, we would dissect it all, we would start to put together, if you like, a framework. Then the next thing we would do is, this would very much determine what questions we have to go out and ask our customers, because we then go out and do a client survey. So we ask them for contact details for hundreds of their clients, and we go out and do a very, very detailed survey of their clients, and I've sent you an example of that. Have you looked at that or glanced at it?
I'm looking at the USP draft activity schedule.
Somewhere there you'll see I sent you survey results for a recruitment company. And you'll see the kind of question we're asking. And we're trying to establish a lot of things when we do one of these surveys. We're trying to establish who is the ideal client, who is it that actually makes the decisions, what size of company is it, what kind of industries are they from. So we're looking at demographic data. We want to know that demographic data, because if later we are sourcing lists or we are running some kind of, let's say, advertising campaign, whether that's web-based or traditional media-based or whatever it is, we want to know who we're talking to. For example, that vehicle leasing company, it turns out that the decision makers, they tend to deal in fleets between 20 and 250 vehicles. That's their range. And it is normally managing director, chief executive, or finance director who makes the decisions. The bigger end of that scale, they might have a fleet manager. But the smaller end of that scale, it is normally the key decision maker there. So again, we start to find out, okay, we only need to speak to these people. We don't need to speak to all the rest of the people. These are the people we need to speak to, we need to focus on. So we're trying to bring out all the demographic data to actually establish who we're going to be talking to. We want to establish what their interests are. We want to establish what magazines and newspapers they read, because we want to go to where we can find a good number of those people in one place when we actually go out there with some kind of campaign. We try to understand all of their attitudes to the industry. So we ask them about their experiences with the vehicle leasing industry, you know, how many vehicles they lease, how many different companies they use, what their experiences are, what do these companies do well, what do they do badly, what's the worst experience they've ever had. And we try to get a handle on a whole series of things to actually understand what the issues are. We try to get an understanding of what their concerns and issues are currently. Generally speaking, now, you'll have exactly the same issues in the US as we have here right now as we speak, and that is you've got things like residual values of vehicles just disappearing through the floor. You've got things like SUVs not selling anymore. You've got organizations like Chrysler who've now pulled out of leasing altogether. They're no longer leasing their vehicles because it was costing them a fortune. You've got rising oil prices and gas prices, which is causing mayhem in the market. It's causing a seismic shift in buying patterns. So again, we want to know all of these trends, because if you're talking to people about what actually concerns them, you're going to get their attention. If you try to talk to them about something that doesn't concern them, they have no reason to look. So we want to know what those issues are, and this all comes out of the survey. But then we write the story around these.
I'm looking at the survey, the one on the recruitment survey. This thing is intense and very detailed. Are these surveys developed individually for each client?
Yes.
You do that, or your staff helps you?
I have one member of staff who gets the first task, so her job, I mean, I showed her how to do it. Her job is to dissect all the information we get in the responses with the initial questionnaires we ask all the key people within the company, and to create a hierarchy which I then will approve, and I will then look at that and make any changes to it if necessary. And I now get her to put together the initial questionnaire. I will always go through it and make further changes if I need to, and then we get the client to approve it, and they may have a few adjustments here and there, and then once that's approved, we go live with it.
Very detailed, and I can see where the hours start piling up. This is very time consuming. For a matter of time, let me ask you this. Is it important to get this core story and this whole USP before you actually start doing the repositioning and the marketing for your client?
Absolutely critical, because otherwise it's like working in a dark tunnel with a blindfold looking for a black cat that isn't there. And that's how most people are doing their marketing. They're making assumptions and they don't know what really is actually going to be important to the marketplace. They don't know who they're talking to. They're just throwing mud against the wall. And this way we know exactly what is going to motivate people, what matters to them, how to get their attention. It's absolutely critical. Now, it adds to the time and the cost at the beginning, no question about it. But again, I could say with certainty, I have regretted every single time we've tried to shortcut the process, because we have not had the kind of result that you can achieve. And it's a very, very competitive world out there, marketing-wise, these days. There's a lot of people competing for attention. You've got to get your homework done right in the first place. Otherwise, you are wasting your time, and you've got to bring a lot of expertise and get your homework done at the same time. And we actually get to a stage where my copywriters, and I have several really skilled copywriters that work with me, my copywriters now, we used to try to show the client that something was happening, pull together a story just out of the responses that they gave us, and it's fine, you know, they can see something's happening, but it takes on a real different dimension and life once we start to get all the survey responses back again, and it changes everything. I mean, you know, apart from anything else, we're not only getting information on the attitudes to the industry concerned or their attitudes to current situations and trends, but we're also asking them about the client company and how they compare with other experiences and what they're good at, what they're bad at, and so on. We're asking a lot of questions around that. And there's lots of areas where we get testimonials out of this. And if you look at that recruitment company I sent across to you, just go to the last few pages and you'll start to see some of the most amazing testimonials you will have seen for any business anywhere in any industry. For example, the vehicle leasing company, they didn't have a single testimonial that they could show people. They did a wonderful job. Their clients sometimes told them, you do a wonderful job, and they knew they did a wonderful job and they tried to do a wonderful job, but it wasn't formally down on paper anywhere, and we got hundreds of testimonials from their clients that are absolutely fabulous.
Wow. Give my HMA consultants any advice about the USP, and I'm thinking specifically don't shortcut the process, because that is the first project our clients are taught to do for the client.
I imagine anybody hearing this interview the first time, hearing 760 hours, they cannot even begin to think how 760 hours can go into it, because there's a lot there. We've got 502 steps we go through to create that. Many, many drafts of things I'm using, professional copywriters I'm using, professional editors, and so on, to start putting it all together. I will go through every single word myself on two or three occasions. I don't normally do the first draft. I will look at it broadly, pick out things I'm not happy with, and we will never normally show it to the client until we've at least got to the third draft stage, because the first draft is really going to be the copywriter's attempt to put the whole skeleton together, and they will have certain interpretations. I will normally look at that and think, we need to be much stronger here. You've overemphasized this. We need to emphasize that more. I'll go through and sort of pick out broadly a whole lot of things that they will work on. They'll go away and rework the whole thing, come back with a lot more, and we'll start to then incorporate all of the stuff that's come out of our surveys, because we also go out and survey the competitors, and we'll even do mystery shopping and visit the competitors, and we'll go through a very comprehensive process to see where the competitors are strong. And I just mentioned this thing about testimonials. This real estate agent, you have the story there. We went into the offices of every one of their competitors, and my mystery shopper, as one of my team, actually asked every one of these agents, well, why should we deal with you rather than another real estate agent? Not one could actually give her a reason why. They all said, well, we're very much the same as everybody else. There's no differentiation. There's no difference. Unbelievable. Do you have anything to prove how good you are? Do you have any testimonials? No. Why would we need that? unbelievable. And we got maybe 300 really good testimonials from people for this particular client. Now, who's going to beat people for share of the mind once that starts coming out in the marketplace?
Right, they're going to go with the one with the proof and the reasons why.
Exactly. And there's industries where nobody even thinks about it.
So for all that work, 760 hours, you've got copywriters on staff, editors, you've got a lot of expenses for your consulting operation. Give the consultants an idea of what this one client has been worth, the vehicle leasing. Can you, in pounds or dollar terms?
Well, producing the basic fundamental materials, because we're earning a percentage on the actual business that's transacted, so we charge that at cost, and this is going beyond all the USP. So if we just talk about the USP side of it, we would charge, let's say, when we just pass on our out-of-pocket expenses, maybe $30,000.
And then you've negotiated a contingency arrangement.
And the contingency arrangement is every vehicle that goes on fleet beyond a certain threshold, we get a fixed fee. And then we also get a percentage when the vehicle goes off fleet, which might be 3 years, 5 years, whatever the timescale is, and the profitability of that unit is known at that stage, we will get a percentage of the gross profits on that unit at the end of that period.
So everything's going well with that currently?
It's going very well. We've just done the first email campaign for that company, and we're just starting to do a whole lot of lead generation activities. This is part of the revamp of what they are already doing. So we're using the same email marketing company that they were using, but we have been very strict in terms of exactly how the offer should be structured, and I've sent you copies of those. You can see those. Have you seen those?
Yes.
So in this case, what we're seeking to do is get people to put their hands up if they are seriously in the market and they are in these sort of key positions, if they're seriously in the market for leasing vehicles. We're not interested in the rest of it. We're not interested in the, what we might call the tire kickers, the window shoppers. We're not interested in the individual ones because they only deal with fleets.
So your contingency deal, do you set it in perpetuity, so as long as you're using your marketing methods?
3 years from the implementation of any individual strategy, and then if we make substantial changes to that strategy, you know, that can carry on.
Okay, so only 3 years, huh?
3 years.
You could end up making hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Let me give you an example. We have a client. They manufacture furniture. They are large leather sofas, natural finish. They look like the kind of thing you would expect to see in a baronial hall. And on that kind of scale, dramatic leather furniture. And it's very interesting history because the business started out with a father and two sons 20-something years ago. It was an antique business in one of the cities in the UK. And for 20 years, they never did more than £300,000 in revenues. Call it $500,000, $600,000. The father retired, two sons took over and were let off the leash, and they added pine furniture as an extra area, and they took it up to $3 million revenues. I was then referred to them by one of my clients who was their biggest client. And next 3 years, they went to $26 million. And they'd come up with this sofa concept at that stage, which did very, very well. That's £26 million, so call it $50 million. Then they were looking around for a product that had global appeal. And they were searching, and they eventually found something. They set up an office in Hong Kong, and they started selling this through some of the trade shows. They were getting orders all over the world. So we were brought in to help them get this product into 10,000 retail outlets around the world, many different countries, where they wanted to supply 6 to 8 containers a year of this product. We jokingly said to them one day, because we were just charging for the time we were putting into it in relation to what they were going to get. This was taking them to £240 million in sales, call it $500 million in sales. And here we are getting a few tens of thousands. So we said to them, half in jest one day, how about you pay us $50 per container? You know, it's $50,000 per container is what they sell for. And, you know, we're adding up the number of containers. And they said, well, you'll earn a lot of money doing that.
You asked for $50 per container?
Yeah.
Okay.
And they said, well, we don't mind how much you earn out of this. I mean, you'll earn a lot more than you were doing it the way you're doing it. We don't mind how much you earn out of this because we'll be earning many times that. So, yes, we would do that on that basis. Now, we didn't actually do that deal, but the seed was sown. And it is the only way I know, you know, without having equity stakes in the business and so on, which has its own problems, it's the only way I know where you can earn a lot more than you're putting in. But you have to be brave in the first place because you've got to swallow a lot of that cost in the first place. You've got to have some damn good processes to be sure of delivering the outcome. And if you don't have those good processes in place, if you don't have the knowledge, if you don't have the expertise, you probably can't deliver the outcome. So you've got to be very sure of what you're doing, and you've got to have some very good systems that can deliver the results time after time after time. But equally, I feel I can afford to be choosy, and there's people I wouldn't want to work with and don't work with because life's too short.
So what happened? Did you negotiate something like that with them?
Well, we agreed a deal with them at that stage, so we just went with that deal. But I've spoken to them about other things that we will do, and it will be done on that basis, and they're very happy to do it on that basis.
That's great. Well, look, I know you've got an appointment, and we're kind of out of time. We could talk for days, I'm sure, about marketing and some of your case studies, and maybe down the road we can do a part 2 to this if you're open to it, if your time permits.
I'm happy to do that, Michael. I mean, has this given you what's useful for you?
Oh, yeah, this is wonderful. You've shared a lot of details and some great stories and some great lessons for our consultants and the visitors to the site. Absolutely. If someone wants to learn more about you, Robert, what would be the best way for them to do that?
I'll give you an exact link. It is linkedin.com/IN/Robert Clay. Robert, RobertClay.
Okay, and on that, we have like a 10-page profile on you and some of your entrepreneurial endeavors since you are 19, and there's a great history on your business experience, which I wish we had time to talk about, but anyone listening to this can read about it. You've really done a lot. Very impressive. You know, we emailed almost 8 years ago, and we're finally talking, and you know, I have to say, it's great meeting you voice to voice, and I hope it's not the last time. I hope we can do another interview and maybe get to know each other a little better.
That'd be excellent.
All right, bye-bye, Robert.
Okay, bye-bye now, Mike.
I hope you've enjoyed this interview and learned some important details about the consulting business from my interview with Robert Clay. If you'd like to get in touch with Robert for any reason, please email me at michael@michaelsinoff.com. That's michael@michaelsinoff.com, or call me at 858-274-7851. For more interviews like this, go to hardtofindseminars.com.